I'm Patricia Pierce. Welcome to the Evolutionary Activist Podcast. We are living at an important moment in our history, a time that is calling us into a new way of being, a new consciousness from which a sustainable, just, and peaceful future can arise. In this podcast, we explore ways to help that future take hold within ourselves so that together we can help it come forth in our world. John Perkins is our guest today, and John is the author of numerous books, including Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which spent 73 weeks on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list. In that book, John revealed his work as an economic hitman, persuading leaders in the developing world to accept loans that would ultimately leave their countries in crippling debt, furthering the flow of wealth to corporate powers, and creating the conditions for the global economic and environmental crisis we now face. In 2016, John published an updated version of the book, The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, in which he exposes how the economic hitman system he was part of has expanded since 9/11 and is now being employed in every part of the world, including the U.S. In addition to John's extensive personal knowledge of the inner workings of what he calls the death economy and predatory capitalism, John brings another critical perspective to this global crisis as a leading expert and author on indigenous cultures who understands the role consciousness plays in the world we create. Included among his books on indigenous cultures are The World Is As You Dream It, Teachings from the Amazon and Andes, and Shapeshifting, Shamanic Techniques for Global and Personal Transformation. John is a founder and board member of Dream Change and the Pachamama Alliance, nonprofit organizations devoted to establishing a world that future generations will want to inherit. He has lectured at Harvard, Oxford, and more than 50 other universities around the world. His TEDx talk, which can be viewed online, is titled An Economic Hitman Confesses and Calls to Action. John, for many years I've been inspired by your courageous and visionary work, and I feel a deep kinship with your worldview, so I just want to thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Patricia. Thank you for having me on your show.
So, for those who may not be familiar with your work and don't know the term, what is an economic hitman?
Well, you know, my real title was I was chief economist at a major consulting firm. I had several dozen people working for me, up to around 50 at various times. And my job really was to identify countries with resources our corporations want, like oil, and then arrange huge loans to that country from the World Bank or its sister organizations. And yet the money would not actually go to the country. Instead, it would go to our own corporations, the Bechtels and the Halliburtons and Stone & Webster's, General Electric's, and so on, to build big infrastructure projects in those countries, things like power plants and industrial parks and highways that, first of all, made huge profits for our corporations, and secondly, really benefited the very wealthy in those countries, the people who owned the industries and made use out of all this infrastructure. The majority of the people, however, suffered because money was diverted from education and healthcare and other social services to pay off the interest on the loans. And in the end, the loans couldn't be paid off. And so we'd go back, usually in the guise of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and restructure the loan and demand that the country sell its resources real cheap to our corporations without environmental and social regulations, or allow the United States to build a military base on their soil, or get them to vote with us against Cuba or something else in the United Nations. Things like that. That really was what we really were doing. We were creating a global corporate empire. And also we'd get them to privatize their public sector things like their schools and their water and sewage systems, their public utilities, and sell them cheap to our investors. The other side of it is that if we fail to convince leaders to take on these loans, to do this, then people we call the jackals would go in and either assassinate those leaders or overthrow them. And so most leaders played the game because they knew what the alternative was. They could either get wealthy playing the game, or they could lose their jobs and possibly their lives by not playing the game.
And you talk about this global empire, which is different from the forms of empire that we've seen in the past. Can you say more about that? Because I think sometimes when people hear the word empire, they think of a particular thing that really isn't what we're looking at today.
Well, you know, an empire, it really is, it's characterized by things like a language that's sort of global, universal on this planet. English is that way, at least in business and politics. A currency that's global, and the American dollar satisfies that. And a country that has huge armed forces, and our budget right now, Pentagon budget is as large as the next seven largest countries' defense budgets put together. It's very large. A military presence in many countries, which we certainly have, and well over 100 countries. So, you know, in a way, you could say that the America, the United States, satisfies the criteria to be an empire. The reality is, these days, it's really not so much an American empire as a corporate empire. And that may not be all that different either, because what the American Revolution was fought against, we like to think it was fought against the British Crown, but really more than anything that incited that revolution was the East India Company, which you know, was the result of the tea tax, Lawson Tea Party. All of that was because of this huge country, company, that to a large degree owned the crown of England, had tremendous influence over the crown, and the crown benefited tremendously off the company too. So it may not be all that different, but what we have today really is a truly global corporate empire. And most of these corporations, and this may be the biggest difference from history, these corporations don't even really see the United States as their home. They don't see themselves as U.S. corporations, although they may be registered here and registered in lots of other countries. A lot of them don't pay any taxes in the United States. They're quick to move, you know, it's the infamous movement of Halliburton from the United States to headquarters in Dubai, and so on and so forth. So they really have no loyalty to the United States, but they do use the U.S. military and other U.S. resources to help them maintain their position.
Now, can you tell us what has changed now in terms of this economic hitman structure since 9/11, since you wrote your first book? How is it different now?
Well, yeah, and that's really why I wrote The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman about 12 or 13 years after the original, because it's really gotten worse. And the economic hitman practices that we were doing in my day were aimed primarily at what we call the third world countries with resources that are relatively impoverished. And we could produce econometric models that showed that investing in those countries in this huge infrastructure projects would increase their GDP, which it did. What the models didn't show was that GDP is, you know, which is a measure of the overall economy of a country, is really skewed toward the very rich. So that in many of the countries where we were doing this, the majority of the people don't even really make the national statistics. So they're a very small part of it. And in fact, we can see this in the world today, Patricia, where you've got eight individuals who have as much wealth as half the world's population. So the fact of the matter is that if those eight individuals are doing very well economically, and half the world's population is staying the same or even getting slightly worse, everything's going to look really good because those eight guys are doing really well. And I began to see that was the case in the countries where I was working. So in those days, when I was in economic hitman, we were really oriented toward those what we call third world countries. Since 9/11, this has really come home to roost. So that we've seen a huge increase of the equivalent of economic hitmen hitting people in the United States and throughout Europe and throughout what we might call the first world or the developed countries. We're being hit heavily with debt, education debt, credit card debt, health debt, all kinds of debt, which is very, very enslaving. and being fed tremendous fear. So in a way, we've been reawoken to what we used to call the Cold War. We fear Russia. We fear Muslim countries. We're really overwhelmed with fear these days, and that's been a change. And the other thing that's happened in the last decade or so is that every major global corporation has its version of economic hitmen. In my day, we were sort of generic. We went into countries, we wanted to get U.S. corporations to make profits off those countries, but we really didn't care which U.S. corporations made the profits as long as it came back to the United States. Today, that still goes on, but in addition, Monsanto has its version of economic hitmen. Nike has its version. Every major corporation has its version of economic hitmen who are out promoting that corporation, trying to work deals, lower labor payments, lower taxes, so on and so forth.
Now, at the end of the book, you talk about a revolution of consciousness that's required of us at this moment in our history. And tell us about your understanding of that new consciousness.
Well, I'm in the blessed position of being invited to speak at conferences around the world and at corporations. This past year, spoke at a huge international economic conference in St. Petersburg, Russia. I shared the stage with President Putin and Secretary General of the United Nations Guterres and Prime Minister of India Modi and many others. And I also speak at universities, and I speak at New Age things. I speak on the things about shamanism. I cross those lines. So I meet people around the world, whether it's Russia or Italy or Turkey or China or Latin America. And everywhere I go, I see that people really are waking up to the fact that we're living on a very fragile space station, the Earth, and we're navigating it toward disaster. And people are really understanding this. And that's a consciousness revolution. There's a true revolution going on. It may be the most important revolution in human history, a waking up to what it really means to be human on this planet. And at the same time, the status quo is feeling that. And so they're putting on the brakes. It's why we've got people elected like Trump and why we've got so much backlash, right? It's part of the cause behind Brexit. It's part of this, and it's also why Sanders was. So we had these two extremes in the United States at one point that looked like they'd be running for president. At one point it was Sanders and Trump. And those two extremes, though, really recognize people coming from the same kind of position where they just are very dissatisfied with the status quo. And then people in power use that as leverage to make us want to stay with the status quo, to make us want to not make major changes. Because even though we're not happy with the status quo, when you start getting blasted with information about what's happening in the world, about the fear of Muslims, about the fear of thieves in your own backyard, say we've all got to have guns, about the fear of drugs, about all these fears, people really don't want big change. They, in their hearts, they want to see change. They're not happy with the current system. But when push comes to shove, because of the fear thing, and also if they've got a lot of debt, they want to keep their jobs. They don't want to see anything that might shake up the economy.
Yeah. When you were a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador, you apprenticed with a shaman in the Amazonian jungle, and you worked with indigenous people in many areas of the world. And from the vantage point of the shamanic mind, when you look at our culture, what do you see?
Yeah, and I still spend a lot of time in shamanic cultures. You know, I take groups of people every year to the Kogi in Colombia in December, and to the Achua in the Amazon in August, and to the Maya in January. And I'd love to have some of your listeners come. If you go to johnperkins.org and look, you'll see these trips and put your name in that little box that you get our newsletters that announce things that are coming up. So I'm very, very in touch with the shamanic world, and the book I'm working on right now gets into that. At the same time, very in touch with the economic world. So it's these two that seem to be extremes. But the fact of the matter is, what I learned from the shamans in many different parts of the world is that we change objective reality through changing perceptions. So right now, there's an objective reality that you and I are using, the microphones we're speaking into. But the words that we're speaking are really impacting perceived reality. And when you come right down to it, there is no religion. There are no countries. There's no United States. There's no Russia. There's no religion. There's no corporations. There's no economy except as we perceive it. And when enough people accept a perception or codify it into law, it has a huge impact on objective reality. And that's very shamanic. And so what we're seeing is we experience a change in consciousness around the world, an awakening to the fact we live on a fragile space station and we're not doing a good job of navigating it. We need to reboot the navigation system. When enough people start to really perceive that, then it starts to change objective reality. And then we start to behave differently. And we hopefully will be moving from an economic system, a global system that's failing us, to one that'll be successful, what I call it, moving from a death economy to a life economy. And so that's very shamanic, really. The shamans are telling us that all we have to do to change reality is change our dream of reality, which translates into changing our perception of what it means to be human on this planet.
Yeah. One thing that you and I share is we were both Peace Corps volunteers in Ecuador, about 20 years apart, I think, but it seems to me that when one experiences life in another culture, it really helps you see your own culture through different lenses. And I remember after 9/11, oh, I guess it was about maybe 7 or 8 months after 9/11, I took a trip to El Salvador, and that experience and coming back to the U.S. after that experience, it just highlighted how our culture seemed to be in this sort of a trance state after 9/11 and hypnotized really into this narrative that was being offered us about, you know, terrorism and the war on terror and all of that kind of thing. And so I'm curious, when you take people from, say, the U.S. or North America to visit some of these shamanic cultures, what sorts of transformations do you see in people as they return?
Phenomenal transformation. I don't think anybody goes on one of these trips that doesn't have a life-changing experience. And I've taken well over 1,000 people on these trips over the years. And I hear from so many of them as to what kind. It's really hard to generalize. You know, I mean, for some of them, it's like they get out of a bad marriage or they get into a good marriage. Or they change their job, something like that. For others, it's much more global, where they really become part of the Pachamama Alliance or the Dream Change Movement or one of these or some other movement. So there's a varying degree, but what the commonality is that I think everybody goes through a huge transformational experience, because even I'll tell people, you know, you've only been gone a week or maybe it's a little longer, but when you go home, just be careful what you say to your friends and neighbors, because they will have only experienced another week at work. And you're going to be telling them you had a life-changing experience in 1 week, and they're going to look at you like, you know, are you crazy? And then in a way, they don't want to hear it because they've just had another week at work. But the fact is, people go through this incredible experience, as you did in El Salvador and probably in Ecuador. When you were Peace Corps volunteer there, it certainly was a life-changing experience for me. And not just because I almost died and got cured by a shaman and used ayahuasca and so forth, but the whole experience was life-changing. To speak another language and to hear what another culture feels, you know, as an example. So I was deep in the Amazon on 9/11. With a group of, I think, 17 people that I'd taken in to live with and learn from the Shwa, an indigenous culture deep in the Amazon, who I'd been a Peace Corps volunteer with. So on the morning of 9/11, at 9 o'clock, every day, we had no communications with the outside world except a shortwave radio. And every morning at 9 o'clock, I'd get on that shortwave radio and talk to our pilots back up in the Andes. Because some days, even the shortwave wouldn't work. So every morning, we'd go on and remind them, yeah, in 2 days, you're going to come and pick us up and fly us out. In 1 day or in 3 days, every day you do that. And so at 9/11, at 9 o'clock in the morning, on their time, which was I think the same as New York time, I'm on the radio, and suddenly the guy at the other end he's got a commercial radio station in his office going in the background, and he says, "Oh my God, your country's under attack." And for the next half hour, he kind of relayed to me in Spanish what he was hearing about what was going on in the World Trade Center. And then I went back to my group of people who were getting very impatient because we were supposed to take a walk to some very beautiful sacred waterfalls, and they're all waiting for me. And I get back to them and I tell them, and four of them out of 17, they either had family or friends that were either in the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. And for almost a week, they were unable to find out what had happened to their friends or to family. And that night we did a shamanic ceremony. And almost everybody did it, and it involved ayahuasca. The Schwa now knew about what had happened. We told them, and they were extremely sympathetic toward us and used that ceremony to help people go deep into what they were feeling, especially those who thought they had loved ones or friends who might have been killed. But at the same time, the Schwa also, and I heard this when I went back up into the Andes a few days later with the Quechua people, so many people were saying, well, we're terribly sorry that this has happened and what a catastrophe for the people involved. But perhaps now your country will understand what it means to be under attack, to have violence come your way. And in the past, a lot of the violence that's come our way has come from your people or from your military or whatever. And it was, you know, very interesting perspective. And of course, when I came back to the United States a few days later, all I heard was but I didn't hear anything about how apologetic we were, how we learned a lesson from this or anything else. All we heard about was that we had to go attack somebody. And it looked like Iraq was going to be the one we were going to attack. And this whole story about weapons of mass destruction. But around the world, and I found out later on, people other places in Italy, in Europe and other parts of the world also had the same kind of feeling that, well, maybe the United States now is going to be a little bit more sympathetic to what goes on in so many other parts of the world. I don't think that happened, unfortunately, but it could be a powerful impact, and it certainly had an impact on the people on that trip.
Yeah, I remember after 9/11, I remember actually watching a newscast. I think it was the News Hour on PBS, and they had a panel discussion, and one of the panelists was trying to bring to the table the possibility that perhaps we should look at what is beneath this anger that provoked this attack. And I remember that person, that woman, being really silenced and shamed and squelched by the other panelists. And it was quite extraordinary to see that that there was this resistance, this unwillingness to really examine the larger context of that
Yes.
terrible attack.
Yes, and we find it over and over. You know, I think I've been to several meetings where people have tried to raise the possibility that it wasn't what the governments told us it was, that it wasn't perpetrated by terrorists, that in fact the question is often asked is who benefited from 9/11? And obviously the arms industry in the United States has been a beneficiary. I'm not suggesting that they did it at all, but what I'm saying is that whenever anybody raises this issue, they get really shot down. And I think that's unfortunate because I think in a democracy, people have the right and in fact, sometimes the responsibility to raise these kinds of issues and to question what's going on. I think I think our founding fathers were very, very cognizant of that when they wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, that we need to question, always we need to question our leaders and our authority and the motives of our country and the motives of our corporations and our policies. And I think questioning is very important. And it is unfortunate that even though we think we have probably the best freedom of the press anywhere in the world, nonetheless, there is this horribly strong bias that the people who are on the big shows can influence by putting anybody down that comes up with an idea or thought that they don't like, which I think is very unfortunate.
I want to thank you for the courage that it took for you to do the writing that you have done and expose the inner workings of what you call the death economy. And I know that you were putting your own life in danger by doing that. And now you've also, I think about the role of Toto in The Wizard of Oz, you know, pulling back the curtain so that people can see what actually is happening. And you have played that role for us. You have pulled back the curtain for us to really understand what's going on. And I first of all, I just want to express my deep appreciation to you for taking that step and taking that risk on behalf of all of us. And I know that probably you may have felt like it was something that you had to do. There was no way you couldn't do it. And you talk about that in your book. Now you're really focusing a lot of your energy, it seems, on what you have talked about before as shape-shifting corporations, because you understand that we're not going to be doing away with corporations and that they have the power to really effect enormous change for the good on the planet. Could you say more about that work of shape-shifting corporations?
Yeah, thanks. I'd like to. You know, I do think that corporations are the most powerful force on the planet by far. Nobody gets elected president of the United States without corporate backing and financing. And I think that's true in most countries. Even you look at a country like China, it's had remarkable economic growth since 1971 when Nixon first went there. But it wouldn't have had that remarkable growth had global corporations not played a huge role in it. So these corporations have tremendous power. And I think they've really abused that power, but they've abused it because they operate under one goal. And that's a goal that was really defined in 1976. Everything shape-shifted for corporations in 1976 in one moment. But if I go back just a little before that, when I was in business school before 1976, I was taught that a good CEO makes a decent rate of return for investors and takes good care of his employees, takes good care of his suppliers, his customers, and is a good citizen, takes good care of the communities where the corporation works, pays taxes. Imagine that. And also maybe invests some money in the education system locally or the recreational facilities, does good things for the community. I was taught that. And then in 1976, Milton Friedman won the Nobel Prize in Economics, and probably his most important statement. He made a lot of statements, but probably the one that's had the most impact was the one that where he says, and I'm paraphrasing, but the only responsibility of business, of corporations, is to maximize short-term profits, regardless of the social and environmental costs. And that suddenly changed everything. It told CEOs that they had the right, and many would say the mandate, to do whatever it takes to maximize profits, including corrupting government officials. Or today it's done legally, so it's theoretically not corruption when you make huge contributions to campaigns, you finance campaigns, and you offer politicians amazingly lucrative jobs after they get out of office as your lawyers or your consultants. So corporations now see that they can basically corrupt politicians, they can destroy the environment, do whatever it takes to maximize short-term profits. And that has changed everything, Patricia. It's led to what I call predatory capitalism, which is capitalism that just destroys and wants to take over any of its competition, destroy the competition or buy them out. And it's really resulted in a death economy, an economic system that's built on destroying resources upon which it ultimately depends. And also, to a large degree, is dependent on militarization, on killing people or threatening to kill people or threatening to be killed by people or whatever. We're really locked into our military budgets and to destroying the planet. And this is taking us to the brink of disaster. The alternative is a life economy. And that's an economic system where you pay investors a decent rate of return. We need investors. We need growth, but we don't need growth in the areas that have been growing in the past. What we need now is growth in areas that clean up pollution and that regenerate destroyed environments and that come up with new processes for recycling, for using the air and the wind and the sun and so forth to create photosynthesis, as the plants are able to do, to create new types of products that do not tear up the earth anymore, that recycle, that reuse. There's a huge opportunity here for amazing growth, economic growth, but in areas that are creating an economic system that is itself a renewable resource. And it's not just an economic system, it's a social, political, economic system, but I like to call it a life economy, because it truly is about life. And it's the kind of economic system that Indigenous people have always had, where they look at the long term, not short term maximization, but long term survival of their cultures and their children and grandchildren. It's a wonderful opportunity that we have today to move into this.
Yeah, and what you're saying about Friedman and that shift, that shape shift among CEOs towards short term profits, I think we all share responsibility in that, because the shareholders bought into that too. And now there's, of course, shareholder activism and so forth, where people are wanting something different.
I can't tell how many chief executives I've talked to at different conferences where I speak, and during receptions over dinner or a few cocktails or whatever, and I so frequently hear from them, I want to do the right thing. I want to do what you're talking about in your speech. I want to create a life economy. But I'm afraid that if I lose a small percentage of market share, or the stock prices of my company go down, my main stockholders will fire me. And then they'll replace me with someone who doesn't care about anything except stock prices or market share. And so they're in a quagmire. And they'll tell me, you know, get out there, tell your people when you speak. They said, you know, encourage everybody to become active consumers. And with social networking, it's so much easier than ever before to form campaigns, to say, to write a letter to Nike and have all your social networking circles send a similar letter and have them send it to all their circles and say something like, hey, Nike, I love your products, but I'm not buying them anymore until you pay your workers in Indonesia a fair salary. You know, start a consumer campaign against any corporation. It could be Nike, it could be Walmart, it could be Exxon, it could be Monsanto. But the important thing is to get the message out there, because a lot of these CEOs want to do better. They have kids, they have grandchildren, they're smart people, they're not stupid. They know that we're in the process of destroying the future, and they want to see change, but they feel powerless to bring it about. They're powerful people within their own industries and their own companies. But in terms of really changing the system, they need us behind them. They need the consumer. They need all of us. We need to change the paradigm, or as the Indigenous people would say, the dream, our perception of reality, to move into a new perception that says the companies that we're going to identify as successful are not those that maximize short-term profits, but those that create a life economy that maximize the long-term benefits for the planet and for people and all other living creatures on this planet. That's where we need to move.
So everybody has responsibility in that, and for us to forego those short-term gains on investments and say, you know, I'm going to choose to not have that short-term profit, and I'm going to invest in corporations that are invested in the future and invested in, as you say, like, you know, to the seventh generation, right? The Indigenous understanding of our responsibility to the future. I think a lot of times we have a tendency to sit back and think that these problems need to be solved in the upper echelons of power. And so we abdicate our own responsibility and our own power and our own role in being part of this change.
Exactly. And, you know, I think we have to remember it wasn't Dow, the president of Dow Chemical, who got rid of DDT, or who exposed the problems of DDT. It was Rachel Carson, you know, a writer and environmentalist. And then that bought on big time with the public, and the public made demands. It wasn't the big corporations that decided there shouldn't be apartheid any longer in South Africa. It was we the people who said we were going to boycott those corporations. And I'm sure a lot of the leaders of those corporations were happy about this, but they couldn't take the initial step. And the same thing with cleaning up rivers. When I went to business school in Boston, you couldn't walk beside the Charles River. It was so polluted. It isn't anymore, because consumers demanded that the corporations that were polluting it clean it up and stop polluting it. It's always been we the people that have had to make these changes happen. And I think it's a really, really important thing to recognize. And I think people have gotten further and further removed from that in many respects. And they just say, oh, yeah, well, you know, it's up to the president. It's up to Trump now. It's up to, or it would have been up to Hillary. It was up to Obama. But, you know, whatever. It's up to the leaders. Well, no, it's up to each and every one of us to change that. We have tremendous power. Every one of us has the same powers if we want to use it as Rachel Carson or Rosa Parks or Mahatma Gandhi, or and every one of those people, when they get started, they were just like all the rest of us, and they had no idea that they were ever going to be successful. And we don't all have to become world-recognized names, but we all have a role to play. A lot of people now these days are looking at how they shop, but it's important to not just look at how you shop, but send the message, hey, I'm not buying your shoes, even though I love them. Until you pay your workers a fair salary, I'm buying somebody else's shoes because they're making an attempt here. So I think it's really, really important that we recognize that we have to keep sending messages out to these companies. The message is so important. That's how we change perception through the stories we tell in our messages.
At the end of the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman, you talk about different ways that we can each help turn the story around or change the dream. And I, first of all, I just want to really encourage listeners to read this book because it's such an amazing work. And I wonder now if you could just highlight, for the benefit of people who are listening right now, highlight a few of those ways that you believe we can individually and collectively help change that story, help change that dream.
Yes, well, the book, you know, I mean, the lists are, there's lists for college students, and there's lists for executives, and lists for entrepreneurs, lists for parents, lists for retired people. There's lists for different specific groups. So, you know, that's where the detail lies. But the overall, I think from a general perception, from a general point of view, we could say that, I can say that the most important thing is to recognize the power of stories and of changing perceptions and the stories that we tell ourselves in whatever way we can, and that each and every one of us has the power to do that. And I think it's really important for people to follow their, what Joseph Campbell called their bliss, to follow our, you know, our heart's desire to do what makes us happy. Because if we launch campaigns and we get bogged down in terribly boring detail, we burn out, and we have to do details. I'm a writer. That's what I do. I love to write, so that's where I direct my energy. And I also realize that there are times in writing where it's a little difficult when I've got to go back in and edit something I don't really want to edit. Well, that's part of life. You know, I got to do a little of that. But overall, I love what I do, and I think people need to focus on that. So let's, as an example, if you're a carpenter and you love to do carpentry, great. But build houses or make your furniture, whatever, with sustainable materials, and tell the story at the same time. Make sure that your clients understand you're doing this. And you might even at times say, well, this might cost a little bit more to do it this way, but you're investing in your children's future by paying a little more money, if it does cost money. You know, and whatever business we're in, we can do that. We can take that lead. If you own a store or work in a store, you can really push the products that are made by companies that are committed to creating a life economy. And none of these companies is perfect at this point, but there are some that are doing much better than others and are trying harder. So push those things and be sure to tell the clients why you're doing this. Keep spreading the story. It's so important that we spread the story. And it's also, you know, another piece of advice is to really get involved in campaigns. You can join. There's so many consumer campaigns, there's environmental campaigns, and it's, or if you want to start your own, you have a particular local issue or corporation, get going. And the internet makes it so much easier than it's ever been before. If you're not comfortable using the internet, good, do it the old fashioned way, you know, make copies of papers that you post that you put up around walls and on lampposts and so on and so forth. But, you know, so again, I think if people want to go to the book and look at the specific list for each category that you're in, that's wonderful, because the lists get very specific. And I think that the general thing is to just say we've all got to play a role and be active and keep telling new stories that spread a better perception that we need to create a life economy, and we can create a life economy, and it's going to be fun, and it's going to happen. It's happening. It's not some pie in the sky dream. It is happening. It's happening right now. More and more people are getting involved in this. So let's keep going.
Yeah. In terms of sharing the story, I want to just say that there's a story that I wrote. It's like a parable, Noah in an Island, it's called. And in it, I talk about this world that we experience as a kind of a dream of the ego mind that sees everything through a lens of separateness and blinds us really to our true nature and the oneness of reality. And I, just for the record, I want to say that part of your experience and part of your work influenced part of that story that I wrote, this call that you received from people in the Amazon to come back and help change the dream that we are participating in that is causing so much devastation on the planet. So I just want to thank you for that, because your work, there's been a cross-pollination between what you do and what I do. Well,
I said, that's great to hear. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you, Patricia.
Yeah. So before we wrap things up, John, is there anything else that you'd like to share with us, with the listeners today?
Well, just I'd like to reemphasize, I feel that we're in an amazing time to be alive. I feel very blessed to be part of this time. And people often get discouraged by what's going on politically or whatnot, but I think all of that is an indication that we are moving into a revolution. And whenever you start to move into a revolution, there's a blowback. You know, you can go to the American Revolution, see how once things get started, there are a whole lot of Tories that emerged and said, no, we can't fight the British, blah, 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 blah. There's always blowback. There's always people putting in their feet, wanting to keep the status quo. But I've been a martial artist most of my life. And one of the things you learn in martial arts is you don't try to use another person's, you don't try to stop their energy. You try to use their energy against them. You circle it around and use it. And you get energy from their desperation. And I think the part of the setback now, part of the attempt to stop the movement, a part of the really right-wing conservative movements that we're seeing today are a recognition that they're losing and we're getting ahead. And I think we need to take energy from that. And I just encourage people to know that we're in an incredible time. To be alive right now is amazing, because we really have the opportunity to do something that human beings have never done before, to create this massive global life economy. And human beings have done it on a very limited basis before. Indigenous people have always done it. But now we are a global community, and we've been shirking our responsibilities as a global community. We're now waking to the fact that we have shirked our responsibilities. There is an alternative, and we're moving into it. And I think it's just such a phenomenal time to be part of that. And I encourage all your listeners to be part of it. I would love to get to meet every one of your listeners. Go to my website, johnperkins.org, sign up for the newsletter. You'll see where I'm speaking next. And if I'm in your community, let's get together. Let's go have a cup of coffee or a beer or something together. Love to get to know you, all your listeners.
Great. Thank you so much, John. And I want to just reiterate what you're saying and really encourage people to go to your website, check out the trips that you lead, and check out your writing, both about the economic system and also about your experience with Indigenous cultures, because I think that we have so much to learn from Indigenous cultures, that we need each other at this moment.
Totally agree. Thanks, Patricia. Keep up your great work.
Well, thank you. I certainly plan to, and the same to you. And again, John, I just want to thank you again for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on your show, and keep spreading this word. It's so important what you're doing. Keep it up. I love what you're doing. Thank you.
Certainly will. Thank you.